Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the second part of the French Connections Friday edition. It is again the date. It is the 24th day of February, 2006. And my guest, his second visit to the French Connection, as I told you in the first segment, is David Pidcock. And David has been working for decades on collecting information and actually codifying many of the facts over historic periods that point to these folks that I've talked about for the last year, the criminal Zionist network in the world, and how they have used their influence and their power to forward an agenda that is killing the planet, in my view. I won't put words in David's mouth, but his work has been seminal in many of the many of the fights that we're talking about. And he's decided to come on and talk about terrorist attacks of the past and how they fit into the London 7-7 and the Oklahoma City, as well as the 9-11 attack on New York. We're going to talk about a lot of things, but I'll bring David up right now. David, it's great to have you with me.
Thank you very much. Nice to be back on your program. It sounds to say quality show is really, I think, downplaying its importance. It is a serious program, and that's what's desperately needed.
Well, you know, there aren't a lot of places in the world that are able or willing or knowledgeable enough to put on these kind of programmings, and that's the reason why I think Eric and I are putting so much effort into this. We need to get more people on board with this fact and these truths. So let's go right to it, David. You know, first let's talk about current events, because it was something that we bantered around before we went on air here. With the mayor of London coming out and actually calling somebody, he used a metaphor for someone's behavior.
Yes.
But got everybody up in arms, and somebody with some power behind them actually got him out of his job for a month, which is astonishing to me. How do you unseat a mayor without an impeachment proceeding?
Very good, but I think it's there is a monumental and horrendous double standard. Ken Livingstone is one of those honest people who sometimes maybe says things bluntly, but we're supposed to have freedom of speech. But in the same week that David Irving, love him or loathe him, is jailed for 3 years for not denying the Holocaust, is when you read the transcript, but actually saying that the gas chambers were not inside Auschwitz, then of course he's jailed for 3 years in Austria. And Ken Livingstone for a similar, well, the indiscretion was calling a journalist and accusing him of behaving like a concentration camp guard, and the journalist was Jewish and has taken it to the point of saying that it was an anti-Semitic remark, when in actual fact I've listened to Ken Livingstone and he said it was, the man was behaving like a concentration camp guard regardless of what his background is. So I think that's this week, and he's been suspended for a month.
Now, who suspended him, David? Who has that kind of juice?
Well, I think the actual body was mentioned on BBC tonight, but I got interference at that point. But it's obviously a body of standards in public life. I think that's the body. He's accused of actually bringing his job into disrepute, etc., etc. But the whole thing was engineered. And Livingstone is one of the people who said if voting was intended to change anything, they'd outlaw it. So he's very outspoken, and he's refused to apologize. And I think rightly so. If somebody is behaving like a concentration camp guard, then Israel is now running the largest concentration camp in the West Bank and Gaza.
So,
unfortunately, Ken Livingstone is also a victim of freedom from speech.
Well, you have to know that, and because you're on the second half of a program where I called Israel a criminal nation that all countries in the world should declare war on.
Indeed. Well, I think that there are some marvelous works, on the subject of Jews living in Israel. There's one marvelous book, Living in Racist Zionist Israel. So it is a pariah state, and unfortunately we in the West here, we created it because we were under pressure to submit or the British Empire would have been dismantled. That was the that was the threat, as Weizmann said, we will come whether you want it or not. And the issue is, the point is whether you like it or not, and the destruction of the British Empire if you don't allow us to come as we wish. So Israel is, of course, it's contrary, it exists, it is the abomination that stands where it ought not to stand, because the Holy Land is not for a Zionist entity, which is a secular, a Shabbatian model.
That's right. And I called it a festering boil that the world should lance. But that was my little metaphor. And well, let's go on to something else at the moment here. We're going to talk today about some research that's it's been forwarded by not just yourself but many people over the generations. In fact, there have been they've used terrorist attacks,
yes.
Fabricated terrorist attacks. For time immemorial, in order to get people on board with sometimes dangerous and other times criminal decisions within government. And so what we decided to do was maybe do a little history of these people's
yeah.
activities in this realm. So where do you want to start with this?
Well,
Dave?
I think the most probably the most important turning point was the sinking of the Lusitania, which was the pretext. Under which America entered into World War One, even though we know from now the archive records, particularly the correspondence between Balfour and Robert Lansing, that we call the Balfour-Lansing correspondence, that America had agreed with the British authorities to enter World War One at an appropriate time. So it was already agreed, as we now know from Bush and Blair and these other things. These are all carefully engineered and choreographed situations. What is interesting is that I'm reading here from a report that was done in the paper. You've heard about Colonel House, a famous individual.
Yes.
And the intimate papers of Colonel House for May the 7th, 1915, and he's having a meeting with Sir Edward Grey at Kew in London, and this is on the day, of course, of the sinking of the Lusitania. Now, he said, this is a quote, "We spoke of the probability of an ocean liner being sunk," recorded House. "And I told him that this, if this were done, a flame of indignation would sweep across America, which would in itself probably carry us into the war." An hour later, House was with King George in Buckingham Palace, and he quotes, and this is a quote, "We fell into talking strangely enough," the colonel wrote, "of the probability of Germany sinking a transatlantic liner." He said, "Suppose they should sink the Lusitania with American passengers on board." That evening, House dined at the American Embassy, and then came the statement that the Lusitania had been sunk. Now, this is interesting. That they, how would they know that it was going to be sunk before it was sunk? And of course, it takes us that the Germans had already warned that the likelihood that that the ship would, in actual fact, could be torpedoed. And this is a warning that was posted in New York on the day of the sailing. And I quote from this, from the Imperial German Embassy, Washington, April 22nd. This is prior to the sailing. "Travelers intending to embark on Atlantic voyages are reminded that a state of war exists between Germany and her allies, and Great Britain and her allies. That the zone of war includes the waters adjacent to the British Isles. That in accordance with formal notice given by the Imperial Government, vessels flying the flag of Great Britain or one of her allies are liable to destruction in those waters, and that travellers sailing in the war zone on ships of Great Britain and her allies do so at their own risk." So this is basically the warning shot, and the fact that they knew that the vessel was carrying armaments. So there again is something that was fully known about and choreographed.
And was there acquiescence of the Germans to this? Because what we've been able to discover over our research is that oftentimes they have their own agents within the government that's supposed to be the enemy.
Yes, exactly.
And we've seen this with the Soviet Union. We've seen it with, I mean, we had Arm & Hammer going back and forth with
sure.
American technology, giving
yes.
it to the Russians, including blueprints for decades.
Yes, absolutely. And for deck chairs and decades. But well, there is here a quotation. It's in a very important, it's part of the book material I'm putting together, which we'll post on the Islamic Party website. And it's about President Wilson. And there's a quote here for the German Jewish princes of the purse in the United States. The evidence points more to the Russian Revolution being a factor than the sinking of the Lusitania. So this is the group, of course, which have been the agent provocateurs and the ones who have benefited and basically been financing most of the wars through it within living memory and beyond.
Yeah. So what we've got is we've got a smoking gun with the connection to this. And we also know that from Untermeyer's work, from Mark Morgenthau, from Brandeis, from Baruch, from Friedman, from so many, wasn't there a team of 120 very influential
127, I think.
127 influential Jews that arrived in London to get the Balfour document in motion, and that was. It was a setup from start to finish, and these folks lied to the American public because Germany at that moment, when this document was being signed, was seen more favorably in the American public than the British were.
Yes, there was of course the strong links with the German finance, German Jewish finance, you know, and the fact that the documents that are interesting, if we look at, for instance, World War II, I have a document here with the joint signatures of Max Warburg and Adolf Hitler on a monetary document dated March 16th, 1933. But of course, Max or Abby Warburg stayed in Germany during the entire period of the war, which of course raises some serious questions, as we mentioned briefly in the last program about the senior German military man who also happened to be Jewish or half Jewish, and that's very, very strange. But there's a brilliant book which I managed to get a copy of called The Rothschild Money Trust.
Mm-hmm.
And George Armstrong, who was a steel manufacturer in the United States,
yep,
wrote this book, and it's absolutely brilliant. It spells out everything about the treachery of people like Warburg during World War One. And he says here, the Jewish-Russian Revolution occurred in 1917 when we were at war in World War One, and Russia was our ally. Paul Warburg, Jacob Schiff, and other members of Kuhn and Loeb, were naturalized citizens of the United States and therefore subject to prosecution for treason. They were guilty of high treason, but the power of the Jewish lobby in our government at that time and since was and is such that they have escaped the consequences of their crimes. On the other hand, despite the treasonable conduct, the Jews were given Palestine upon President Wilson's insistence. Now, this is an important point. Furthermore, he said it has taken 22 years to find out the whole story of our betrayal into World War One. We are indebted to Senator Nye, Gerald Nye of North Dakota, for digging into the records and bringing to light the Balfour-Lansing correspondence by which Wilson, President Wilson, is shown to have agreed to enter the war long prior to the sinking of the Lusitania. In his tireless efforts to keep this country out of the war, Senator Nye discovered and revealed the truth and the reason for President Wilson's change of front. Prior to the revelations, we thought we entered the war because of the sinking of the Lusitania and the violation of our rights as neutral. But that was not the real reason, and conclusively shown by the Balfour-Lansing correspondence, it was only a pretext to secure the support of Congress and the people.
So let's discuss for a moment, if you know the statistics, how many murders were committed on that Lusitania? How many people died in that sinking?
The actual numbers that died, I think there were 1,200 that were actually on the vessel. I think there were the total number of lives lost were the ship on the ship were 1,198. Of these, 755 were passengers, and the remainder were members of the crew. Of the drowned passengers, 124 were Americans and 35 were infants. Remember the Lusitania became the battle cry as Remember the Maine acted as a spur to Americans during the war with Spain. So they were the numbers. Of course, slightly less than happened in the next day of infamy, which of course was the fleet at Pearl Harbor, which we'll come to, I'm sure, later.
Well, yes, indeed. There were 2,700 sailors lost in that, weren't there?
Yes, indeed.
But I mean, even you mentioned another one, and this may not have had anything to do with Britain or it may have, but the Maine was a false terrorist attack on Spain. Didn't do that.
No. Of course, these are the book that I have reissued is called Propaganda in the Next War. This was published originally in 1938. And this book was written by a man who was, in his final incarnation, was the chief publicist and propaganda expert for the Army War Council. And in that book he writes, and Senator Nye that I previously mentioned, Senator Nye of North Dakota, in actual fact, mentions this on the Congressional Record, and in 1939, warning that Britain is planning to get Japan to attack America. And this is all spelled out, and Senator Nye, of course, is on the record as having warned the American Congress and Senate that this was in actual fact going to happen, and it happened exactly as we saw.
Well, now he says Britain is going to. Now let's be more accurate. I mean, the British public were lied to, just like the Americans.
Of course.
Who within Britain? Who were the decision makers of the day that were doing this? I mean, of course, the financiers were demanding it, but who was acquiescing to their demands within the government? Was Churchill himself involved?
Well, Churchill was, of course, First Lord of the Admiralty in World War One, and of course, David Lloyd George was compromised, as was Wilson, and so it was. Basically, the British people have been sold out for 300 years. You have a little less of history, but you were most people have been betrayed by the bankers or the banking system. So it is qui bono, who benefits? And always you find that the harvest, wars are the harvest of bankers under the present system that we're forced to operate under. But it was the betrayal, and of course we know that that Churchill was seriously compromised, and Brandes, the American who served, I think, was one of the senior, and Baruch were the main architects of actually subjugating Churchill and bankrupting him pretty well.
Well, you know, that's interesting, and I want to do a sidebar here and before we return to our conversation. It seems like Charles de Gaulle was not part of their clique. He went up against them, and boy, did they despise him for it.
Oh, indeed. Yes, well, this was precisely, de Gaulle was, I suppose, a wild card, a bit like Napoleon. You know, the revolution went one way, but he, like Napoleon, went entirely in the opposite direction to the one that had been originally planned. So, yeah, de Gaulle insisted on not joining NATO. He insisted on an independent French nuclear deterrent. Good for France. I mean,
well, they actually referred to him as a cretin, but the facts were that this man said, you know, no to these folks, and I mean, France is still very compromised by these people, but not in the same way, I don't think.
No, I think that there is a general awareness that there is something seriously wrong, and and most people have a sense of fair play, so they wouldn't like to say anything until they're absolutely certain, and we've had many decades of people coming to realize there is something seriously wrong but not daring to think the unthinkable. The French, of course, have had a long history of being at war with England, particularly England, because the most people have no grudge with the French or the Germans or any. But it's we've fought everybody, but the real enemy, which is in the City of London.
Well, there
and,
it is,
and that is the real enemy.
Well, so now we're in a situation with the Lusitania sinking. Now let's move forward 25 years. Everyone predicted the Second War. Everyone knew that the war reparations being demanded. By the way, those demands were made by and large by that same community who got the Balfour signing done. And of course, we knew we were being set up for a second war. And of course, they financed Hitler. That we had Harriman in New York sending in money through the Bushes.
Yes.
In fact, George Bush's grandfather was brought up in front of a Senate hearing for trading with the enemy. Was he
correct? 1942. Yes. He ran the Nazi Union Bank on Broadway, and they were arrested in 1942 for trading with the enemy. And of course, Alan Dulles was the architect of keeping everything hidden from the authorities. But yes, they were very much involved, right up to the hilt. And of course, were just one little additional thing, which is quite nasty in the Walker side, is that he was the one of the founders of the eugenics movement, of course, which is a very much a racist organization. So they're also responsible for that nasty group.
Planning genocides within populations.
Yes, it's very much like Malthus, and this, if you look at the AIDS virus and other things, you'll find these were created as part of the culling, a higher form of culling or higher form of killing. And there was a very good program done by Robert Strecker in the States, who discovered that the virus was developed at Fort Detrick as part of the population reduction program in line with Kissinger's NSSM 200, you know, the National Security Memorandum, which calls for a reduction of population by economic means where possible, by military means where necessary.
Well, what I do know recently was that they started inoculating people for polio in some African countries when they
It was smallpox, in actual fact. But if there's another one for polio, that was in right at the beginning in 86, and I have the front page of the Times showing that smallpox inoculation program linked to AIDS outbreak. And
not just the AIDS. They had one that they were sent off to an Indian laboratory, and it came back that it had sterilizing agents in it, and it was actually for polio. This was in 1994.
Okay, right. Well, that's something I'm not familiar with, that, but these are the four horsemen of the apocalypse, you know, famine, war, etc. We have got exactly those people with us, and I think if we start to reread our scriptures, we'll find that we are in the end times, and we are looking at these are the stable managers of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, if not the direct people.
Well, you know, I come at this from a non-religious angle, and I see these people actually writing the script based upon scripture.
Yes.
Rather than actually having any kind of divine capacities. I don't believe there's anything divine in their efforts, whether it be evilly divined or not.
Demonic, I think.
Demonically divined, yeah.
Yes.
And, well, here's the next question. We get to World War II. We know the Roosevelt family is up to their eyeballs with these people, including his entire administration being run by either Zionists or by crypto-Jews. And he sets the country in motion to get into the war through the same kind of nefarious means that were done in the first war. And Britain was the people that you guys were the ones that set this in motion in the Pacific, weren't you?
Yes. The whole battle was that there's a very good book published by Yale, which I've included in Delusions of Candor, which is one of the articles I've done for a number of the newspapers in the Gulf region. And you'll find that Yale University, there's a book by James A. Beard called Roosevelt and the Coming War, in which I have taken the extracts from the actual cabinet papers and the diary of Henry Stimson, and who he said then he goes to the White House with General Marshall, and he says then at 12 o'clock General Marshall and I went to the White House, where we were till nearly 1:30, and where the President brought up the likelihood that we would be attacked as soon as next Monday, for the Japanese are notorious for making attacks without warning. and the question was what we should do. The question was how we would maneuver the Japanese into firing the first shot without allowing too much danger to ourselves. Now, this was on the 25th of November when that was entered into his diary. The book is called The Coming War, Roosevelt and the Coming War, A Study in Appearances and Realities by Charles A. Beard at Yale University Press.
Yeah, well, so what you're pointing out here is that what people have suspected, and it's been bantered around in America for many, many generations, that Roosevelt had foreknowledge of that attack. The fact is that this pretty much spells out that knowledge. And what it was that basically we set up our fleet. In fact, there was an order sent to the Pacific Fleet to be ported, but they kept out their most important ships.
The flat tops, yes.
Yes, the flat tops. And they brought in all of their battleships, and they lined them up for the kill.
Yes. Now, this is very, very interesting. I've just brought up this issue of Senator Nye, who actually... So pre-warns America. Now, this on the April the 25th, 1939, in the Congressional Record of the 76th Congress. Now, it's volume 84, number 82, pages 6597-6604. And Senator Nye, I don't know if he's still with us, but anyway, this man was a real hero, that he spoke out. And this is what he states on the Congressional Record. This is 1939, remember the book we mentioned, Propaganda, was published the year earlier.
Yep.
And he goes on to say, there has been published a series of works under the title The Next War. One of the volumes in this series is entitled Propaganda in the Next War. This particular volume was written by one Sidney Rogerson. I've been unable to find any trace of his background or of his connections. But the editor-in-chief of all these works, there are eight volumes, including the one entitled Propaganda in the Next War, is a man whose name is recognized the world over as an authority in Great Britain. He is none other than Captain Basil Liddell Hart, associated with the Times of London, a military historian and authority in Europe. Mm-hmm. And the following are quotations from his authority. So Liddell Hart is a famous character in British military circles. And, of course, Senator Nye, I'm not sure if he was a Democrat or Republican, but anyway, this is what he quotes on the Congressional Record, and he points out what the plan was of the British. Now, the man he didn't know of was Sidney Rogerson. Now, I've found out who he was. He was Captain Sidney Rogerson, known to Winston Churchill. He wrote 12 Days, which was about the trench warfare in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
He was chief publicist for the Federation of British Industry, ICI, Imperial Chemical Industry, and chief public relations officer for the Army War Council in London. So he's not a loony lefty. This guy is the man who's basically the authority. So now, the quotation from Senator Nye is, for some time the issue as to which side the United States would take hung in the balance. The final result was a credit to our propaganda. There remained the Jews. It had been estimated that of the world population of approximately 15 million, no fewer than 5 million are in the United States. 25% of the inhabitants of New York are Jews. During the Great War, we bought off this huge Jewish American public by the promise of a Jewish national homeland in Palestine, held by General Ludendorff to be the masterstroke of Allied propaganda that enabled us not only to appeal to the Jews in America, but to the Jews in Germany as well. And this was why Ludendorff and Hitler and many others were basically aware that in the coming war or the next thing, Ludendorff was annoyed that he hadn't thought of it first. That's one thing, but he clearly understood that they had been betrayed. Because if you were to promise the Palestinians now something, then of course in the future, of course they were promised control of Palestine, but of course they were betrayed by Lawrence and the whole machinations.
Right.
Now, the bit about Japan, and this is very important, if I can just bear with me for 2 minutes.
Yep, yep.
Now, this is what the quote is from the book Propaganda in the Next War, which is why Senator Nye knew, or of course, Senator senator. He wasn't a congressman, he was a senator.
Yep.
To persuade her, the United States, to take our part will be much more difficult, so difficult as to be unlikely to succeed. It will need a definite threat to America, a threat, moreover, which will have to be brought home by propaganda to every citizen before the Republic will again take arms in an external quarrel. The position will naturally be considerably eased if Japan were involved, and this might and probably would bring America in without further ado. At any rate, it would be a natural and obvious object of our propagandists to achieve this, just as during the Great War, they succeeded at embroiling the United States with Germany. Fortunately, with America, our propaganda is on firm ground. We can be entirely sincere, as our main plank will be the old democratic one. So then he goes on to say, we must clearly enunciate our belief in the democratic form of government and our firm resolve to adhere to it. Our minor propaganda will aim at attaching the support of important sections, such as the Jews, probably by a declaration of a clear-cut policy on Palestine, if victorious, and to put an end to anti-Semitic persecutions and of Roman Catholics as well. So he's saying that the natural bias of the U.S. is for English or for British films rather than Japan, Germany, or Italy. So that's the crux or the gist of what Nye puts on the congressional record.
Now let me ask you about the timeline here, because this is probably important. Had the Germans already forged their relationship with Japan, and was that something that they pre-positioned in advance of the attack? I mean, they were already allied when America was bombed on the 7th, were they not?
I think so, yes, there was. But Japan had already been given an ultimatum. Japan was forced, basically, because the British had notified them of the likelihood of an attack from the Americans. This was the whole posturing. The British, of course, knew. They'd broken all the things that had actually happened, and they were aware of the actual information from Japan and from Germany. They knew all the codes. So it wouldn't have come as a surprise. But Japan had been prevented from actually gaining rubber and oil from Indonesia. And that was, of course, these were the eight things that are mentioned in the book that I mentioned earlier, The Coming War, the eight ultimata which no country would have accepted. So it goaded them into actually attacking.
Well, so now we're in a situation where they actually set up 2,700 deaths for this, but
yes.
But for these people, David, these are small change deaths that we're talking about. When you take a look at World War I, Armenia, Soviet Union's murders through the hands of these people, we're talking 100 million murders in the last century.
A Chinese person, the Hong Kong Chinese person said, it would have been far better that we had Japan as our ruler than Mao, who, of course, who killed more Chinese than anybody else.
And Mao was Mao installed by these people?
Of course, yes. I mean,
yes.
He definitely was. Nothing happens by accident, as Roosevelt said, and nobody can come to power. As we found, of course, with the Bolshevik Revolution, it's the same bankers, the same American and British politicians who have been instrumental in installing all these regimes, including in the Middle East. All the Arab regimes, pretty well, are imposed. An interesting thing, sticking with the issue of Pearl Harbor, I did a program with Miles Copeland on the eve of Gulf War I in Birmingham, and this was in the television studio there. It was Central Television, and on the program were General Sir John Hackett, Miles Copeland, the Hazard Tomorian, who was with the Times, and the leader writer for the London Evening Standard. When I was introduced as David Pidcock, the leader of the Islamic Party of Britain, Miles Copeland said, "Hi, David." He said, "So what's your take on it?" And I'd just finished reading his book, The Game Player, which is an important book to read. You remember he wrote The Game of Nations?
Yeah.
But The Game Player is his autobiography. And Copeland said, "Well, oh, so what's your take?" So I said, well, the sinking of the Lusitania was the pretext for America entering World War One, and the sinking of the fleet at Pearl Harbor was the pretext for her America entering World War Two, and the sinking of the U.S. Kuwait is the pretext for occupying the oil fields of Hejaz. And he said, Christ, we're going to have problems with you, but you're absolutely right. And everybody more or less fell off their chairs. So he was an honest man, Copeland, for all his, let's say, his shortcomings. But later he said, when people start to understand what we've done, then America will go up in smoke because of what they've discovered that they've actually done in their name.
Well, you know, they've done this now. They needed another event, and it was, yeah, in the P2 documents in America. What am I trying to think of here? When they were doing the Bush group there, Rumsfeld and the rest were doing their planning. They actually talked about having an event of 9/11 in order to propel us into to the second stage of this thing.
Yes.
Now,
but if I can just interrupt at that point, I have a very important document to mention to you, mm-hmm. which was written by the America's former ambassador James Akins to Saudi Arabia, and this is a report that I managed to get a copy of. He couldn't get a copy of this, his own report, which is interesting. The entitlement of the document is War for Oil with Armageddon as Fun City. So I'm sorry I interrupted you, but I just wanted to say that there is a very important document that I have.
Yep.
It took me nearly 5 years to get it from under the Freedom of Information Act.
Okay.
Should I continue?
Yes, please.
Right. The interesting thing is it came to me from the Department of State. It was posted in 2002, in June, but it was withheld. The actual document was stamped and then withheld for a year because the Gulf War then, of course, had intervened. But I have the document. It came from the United States Department of State. It took me 5 years. It came from Margaret P. Graffeld, Director of Office of IRM Program Services. And the airgram was one that was sent by James Akin, who, unlike many, was not an honest man sent abroad to lie for his country. He refused to lie for his country. And this document, which I can send to you, which I'll let you have copies of, is very important. War for Oil with Armageddon as Fun City. What we're seeing in Iraq today is exactly what he predicted would happen in 1975. His report was written on the 1st of March 1975 and revised on March the 30th. So this went out, and I spoke to him. I'd been told by Colonel Turner, who you had on the other day, I think.
Yes, that's right.
Barry Turner gave me the coordinates from Who's Who, and I rang Washington and asked if this was the office of Mr. James Akins. His secretary or his wife answered, and then James Akins came on and he told me what had happened. The story was that he had objected to the war for oil policy, which was Henry Kissinger's.
Right.
And he'd said live on television, but he didn't know, when he was asked, what do you think about invading? Now, the plan was, according to his document, to depopulate Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait, repopulated with American oil men from Oklahoma, and that was the policy. And when the Third World came complaining about the takeover, you would sell them oil at 2.5 cents a barrel, or $2.50 a barrel. And that was the plan. And he came on television and said, whoever has proposed this is either a criminal, a madman, or an agent of the Soviet Union. And in his letters, I have the correspondence from him, he said, people thought that I knew it was Kissinger who had actually given the briefing to the 12 newspapers or magazines. And he said, I may be brave, but I'm not suicidal. Had I known it was Kissinger, I would be more diplomatic in my choice of words. But, of course, Kissinger was outraged, and my diplomatic career ended shortly thereafter. But this document is proof that there is a policy to control the oil fields by any means possible, which is a continuation from what the British were doing from 1880.
Well, let me tell you something that I know about the oil, so-called oil shortage in the world. It's not a shortage at all. What it is that they want to take control of all of the sources of this so that they can get a maximum price for a minimum effort.
Yeah.
And so there's plenty of oil out there. In fact, they've got wells capped all over the world.
Yeah.
And the idea is that if they can take offline the Iraqi oil and take offline the Iranian oil, the oil they are pumping is going to go up to $150 a barrel,
yeah,
and they're going to make a fortune with a very small amount of effort.
Now, I know this from also with the Sudan. Sudan has, I think they've calculated, vast reservoirs of oil. Texaco and Chevron. I met a guy called Anson Parker from Texas who had drilled many of the holes there, but they were ordered to say they were dry, they were dry wells. But Sudan has large volumes of oil, and of course the gas as well, which the French have taken, and hence the civil war there is to try and divide the country, and of course it's war for oil. This is what Akins is pointing out.
Well, it's also fits in with their eugenics program of depopulating that part of the world.
Absolutely.
Now, here's the other thing. I mean, up in the north slope of Alaska, we've got an ocean of oil under the ground there, and they have, and including gas, that they're returning it back into the earth with these giant engines. And the Prudhoe Bay is just one solid ocean of oil under the ground.
Right.
The facts are is that they don't want the oil out. They want to keep it as a scarce resource, much like
De
Beers.
Yes.
It's just like De Beers has done with the diamonds.
Yes, exactly. The De Beers are on you, I suppose. That's what they say.
The Oppenheimers.
Yes. Now, just if anybody's interested in that, James Akins, he's described in Who's Who as an American diplomatist, writer, lecturer, born in 1926, educated in Akron University, U.S. Navy, 1945-46. He taught in Lebanon, Kuwait, Damascus, and was director of fuels and energy in 1968 and 72 in Washington, and ambassador from 73 to 75 in Saudi Arabia. So a very nice man. If you get a chance to speak to him, maybe you could do a program with him. That would be a brilliant one.
It would be a brilliant one. And here's the next stage of this. See, what they needed and what they've always needed and what we've been able to discover is they need people who are pliable and malleable in the leadership positions that have a profile, basic profile. What Eric and I have discovered, interestingly enough, is that even people such as Einstein were a fraud. I mean, the idea is that they put somebody in a position to take the accolades, to take the center stage, like George W. Bush.
Yes.
And he's basically an imbecile who his strings are being pulled by these powerful forces, and he is virtually just this, he's a talking head is what he is.
Well, it's interesting. Wouldn't, under his grandfather's ideas of eugenics, he would have been sterilized at birth, wouldn't he?
Well, I think he was. I think he's just...
And the two daughters of virgin birth, I suppose.
Well, no. I think they're probably...
Apart from the genesis.
Well, I don't want to get into it, but, you know, it might be the gardener or something. But the facts are, this guy is... He doesn't have the brains he was born with. And the fact is, how did he have children when he's having slap and tickle sessions with Jeff Gannon is anybody's guess.
Well, I'm not sure. I don't know much about that. But the interesting thing, if you, there's a film that you ought to see then in relationship to Reagan and Bush.
Yeah.
Is Peter Sellers' film Being There. And if Chance the Gardener, where you mentioned Chance, then you have to see the film. Peter Sellers took him 10 years to finance it. He actually financed it himself. But it is one of those brilliant pieces of work that's been done. It's humorous, but it's brilliant.
What's the name of it again?
Being There.
Oh, I've heard of this. Yeah.
Being there, Peter Sellers, and which the lady, of course, he becomes president, doesn't he? He becomes the advisor to the president,
mm-hmm.
and all he is a gardener, Chance the Gardener, who answers questions with, in the spring we will see a green shoot, and everybody thinks this is some real deep meaning, and it's a brilliant, it's such a funny film.
But
the lady says about Chance the Gardener, she says, short-changed by the Lord and as dumb as a jackass, and that's, I always see Joe doing think, well, this is precisely, this is Chance the Gardener. Peter, if you see that, it is a beautiful satire about American politics, but it's so close, and obviously he had to finance it himself.
Well, you know, and of course his career went into the toilet as a result.
Yes, of course, but the thing is that this is the price we have to pay, everybody, if you once you start on this road, you have a problem. You have to be prepared to be a victim of whatever they throw at you. But we can't. That shouldn't stop us.
They've done so many things to me, and I got to be honest with you. I got to tell you something, David. Anything short of killing me is just an irritation.
Well,
you know. And the interesting thing is
but as you say, you know, somebody said to me that, well, remember, David, nobody gets out of this place alive.
Well, that's right. Well, here's the thing: when we move these issues forward, like we're doing today, like we've done in the past, the fact is people do appreciate the access to these older facts, because look, many people in the world are not aware that this has been an ongoing generational conspiracy.
Yes.
That is really coming to its zenith as we speak.
Yes. Yes.
And the whole goal is to completely control that Middle Eastern region and to install a global government centered in Jerusalem. Am I wrong?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, the world government was called for. I have the document here. It was actually called for in 2003, and Gorbachev, of course, Ben Gurion's prophecies are very important to see from 1962, that nothing's happened in the world except what he predicted would happen, and it's in my book. If you go on the website to the Islamic Party, you can download Satanic Voices, Ancient and Modern,
mm-hmm.
In which you'll find on page 125 Ben-Gurion's prediction for the world by 1987. And everything that you read in that has come true almost as predicted. He said, this was in Life magazine and Look magazine, 16th of January, 1962. David Ben-Gurion, of course, was the first prime minister of Israel, atheist, and he said, "The image of the world in 1987 is traced in my imagination. The Cold War will be a thing of the past. The internal pressure of the growing intelligentsia in Russia for more freedom and the pressure of the masses for raising living standards may lead to a gradual democratization of the Soviet Union." It actually occurred, Glasnost and Perestroika, at 87.
Right.
And, of course, their man was Gorbachev. And then, on the other hand, the increasing influence of workers and farmers and the rising political importance of men of science may transform the United States into a welfare state with a planned economy. Western and Eastern Europe will become a federation of autonomous states, having a socialist democratic regime, with the exception of the USSR, as a federal Eurasian state. All other continents will become united in a world alliance, at whose disposal will be an international police force. All armies will be abolished and there will be no more wars. In Jerusalem, the United Nations will build a shrine of the prophets to serve the federated union of all continents. This will be the seat of the Supreme Court of mankind to settle all controversies among the federated continents as prophesied by Isaiah. Higher education will be the right of every person in the world. A pill to prevent pregnancy will slow down the explosive natural increase in China and India. And by 1987, the average lifespan of man may reach 100 years. And this was in A Struggle for World Power by George Knopfler. Now, that was now called for by Shimon Peres. They had a big conference. Already the Supreme Court is built. Everything is ready to go. and Gorbachev was there. Now, the calling was by Shimon Peres was that that Jerusalem be declared a United Nations city, and that Kofi Annan would be the first mayor. So that was what was called for. And Ben-Gurion predicted it, but everything's gone according to that plan.
Now, where did the Lubavitch come into this picture?
Well, Ben-Gurion, as I've found from the recent material, of course, came from Turkey, and he was very much involved in the Shabbatian group. There's no doubt that all of them come from Shabbat Zvi, you know, from 1666. This whole cancer that we've seen throughout the Young Turk Revolution was entirely Jewish. The Bolshevik Revolution was entirely Jewish. And yesterday, or rather early on Monday, we had the spokesman from Israel's foreign ministry actually saying, well, of course, these nasty people from Hamas are saying that we actually made money from the war, that we were, that Jews were behind World War One, the Bolshevik Revolution, and the Second World War, and profited, etc., etc. Well, of course, I'm just writing a reply to him, which I'll post to you. But of course, my research shows clearly, and it's in Satanic Voices, Ancient and Modern, the Young Turk movement was entirely Shabbatian, and of course, what's intriguing for maybe for non-Muslims and many Muslims, they're completely unaware of the prophecies that everything that's happened is predicted in prophecies relating to what happened in Turkey and Constantinople, the evidence for. Winston Churchill's marvelous statement in 1920 about who was behind the Bolshevik Revolution, I don't think it can be equal, but of course then after that he was nobbled. But I have here something that you may find interesting from a Senate hearing in February the 12th, 1919, before the United States Senate, the Reverend George Simmons, who was the superintendent of the Methodist Episcopal Church in St. Petersburg from 1907 to October 1918, made the following statement. In December 1918, out of 388 members of the revolutionary government, only 16 happened to be Russians. All the rest were Jews, with the exception of one U.S. Negro. 265 of these Jews came from the Lower East Side of New York. Such has been the condition of affairs in the USSR from that day to this. And though a number of Jews were liquidated in the so-called Moscow Purge, this affected the situation in no way. It merely signified that one Jewish faction had triumphed over another and liquidated another. There has never been anything by the nature of Gentile revolt against the Jewish domination. So that's, again, from the archives in America.
Well, you know, David, we're aware of this. Eric and I are, and many others that listen to the French Connection, and many others who are historians and who've looked into these things. What we do know is this. We know that there are so many people out there trying to mis- and disinform us. It's a simple story if you look at it rationally, and yet it gets so convoluted because the brainwashing that the world has undergone has up is down and right is left and black is white. And what we need to do here is break down these aversions people have to this truth, because that is the real goal of this broadcast, is to break down those barriers. How do you suggest we do that, aside from just pounding away at the facts?
Well, I think the fact that the facts are being broadcast at all is a miracle. Of course, Internet... the webcasting capabilities are so fantastic. I don't think you can do any more than you're doing without you have some serious resources. It's down to money at the end of the day. Let's be perfectly clear about that. We campaigned as the Islamic Party, but there is no support. It's sort of, but you need, if the enemy or the opposition or the ignorant spend billions or hundreds of millions, you can't, for $1.50, expect to make any great impact, because they've bought at the consciences of people. I have a marvelous quote here from Richard Brinsley Sheridan about Parliament. And, of course, he is the one who he wrote The School for Scandal and The Rivals in 1775. But the media is so powerful. But this is what he said. Give me the liberty of the press, and I will give the minister a venal House of Peers. I will give him a corrupt and servile House of Commons. I will give him the full swing of patronage of officers. I will give him the whole host of ministerial influence. I will give him all the power that place can confer upon him to purchase submission and overawe resistance. Yes, armed with the liberty of the press, I will go forth undismayed. I will attack the very fabric of that mighty engine. I will shake down corruption from its height and bury it beneath the ruins of the abuses it was meant to shelter. How about that?
Now, that's an exact description of the world we live in.
Now, also read Gulliver's Travels. Read Gulliver, a marvelous, you know, Jonathan Swift. Nothing's improved in 300 years.
No.
We are still, at the, you know, in the in a situation where we have no democracy. We have the illusion.
Well, you know, democracy, according to Aristotle, was the next the precursing stage to tyranny.
Yes.
What we need is a constitutional republic with teeth.
Yes, of course, and you've got the best constitution, probably, you know, in the terms of modern, the way it's put together. But you mentioned something earlier, and I forgot to just to mention, you were talking about the millions, or the people who've died. When we look at the war on terrorism, let's say, when you look at the amount of deaths that terrorism has caused, and we're not saying that they are acceptable at any price, but and you look at then the deaths from terrorism versus starvation per day, based on the CIA and UN data from 68 through to 2003, terrorism accounts for 1.25 deaths per day, yet starvation accounts for 23,468. You know, that puts the thing in perspective. If terrorism comes from poverty or the fact that you wish to keep people in ignorance, and ignorance, of course, is our greatest threat.
Well, I think we've got like 10,000 deaths a day on our highways,
yes.
You know, if you want to put it in even a different different light.
Yes.
You know, David, I got to tell you that this is, again, I want to call it a broadcast because at some point we're going to have people going, whoa, too much one time. However, you know, I do. You're a great educator on these subjects, and again, I want you back as soon as you can possibly do it. Because, look, this is a series of educational spots that I've done. You know, we did Mr. Owens yesterday, Robert Owens.
Oh, did you? Oh, good,
yes.
Good.
And it wasn't as lively as I had hoped, but it was very informative.
Yes.
And of course, your work and many others. We have people on the state side doing their research.
Yeah.
I've got to tell you, this is a long-term battle. And
yeah, sure.
I'm wondering if we can't, you know, if we can't head off. I'm wondering if we've had an effect already on their timetable.
Well, you know, it's the dripping away syndrome that, of course, there is a very good book done by a Chinese gentleman. He's a barrister called Matthias Chang, Future Fast Forward, the Zionist Anglo-American Empire Meltdown. He is a friend of Mahathir, or he's an advisor. This is a book... that actually is covering many of the things that we're talking about now in a very, as a lawyer would write something, and it's not rambling, it's very accurate and to the point. So, but there was something, if I could just say, the argument, the issue of Israel, I want just to read this if I could, is that in 1919, on the 3rd of January, King Faisal of Iraq wrote this letter at the behest of Richard Meinhertzhagen, General Allenby's chief of intelligence and a member of the team, and he wrote this: "We feel that the Arabs and Jews are cousins in race and have suffered similar oppressions at the hands of powers stronger than themselves. We Arabs, especially the educated among us, look with the deepest sympathy on the Zionist movement. We wish the Jews a hearty welcome here. People less informed and less responsible than our leaders and yours, ignoring the need for cooperation of the Arabs and Zionists, have been trying to exploit the local difficulties that must necessarily arise in Palestine in the early stages of our movement." Now that, who would imagine that came from the man who became King Faisal? But this is part of the problem that both of them, Faisal was, of course, controlled by Lawrence and Gertrude Bell, but that's what people can be made to sign up to. And nobody, or very few people in the Arab world, know about that letter.
Well, they're going to know about it because we're going to tell them about it, David.
Good.
And I want to thank you. You know, your work your work is exemplary, and your efforts are laudable, my friend. And I got to tell you, the French Connection is, you know, we're honored to have this kind of presentation.
Well, it's our duty. We're here to serve.
That's right.
We're
I am
here
to
serve.
And,
sure.
And the fact is, you know, we all have families that we love, and I don't want my children and my children's children living in tyranny.
No.
And I will stop these people with my last breath, if possible. So we're going to do another broadcast sometime soon, David.
Okay.
We'll pick a subject and we'll pick a day.
Okay.
In the meantime, we're going to put in motion all kinds of plans to maybe expand this message with
sure.
Eric and others.
Yes,
and I
indeed.
Want to thank you again. If you want to contact me, you know my coordinates.
Yes. Thank
Please.
You very much. And in the words of Rabbi Goldstein in Netra Karta, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Okay, thank you,
okay.
sir, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. Good night. God bless.
Bye-bye now. Ladies and gentlemen, that was David Pidcock, a historian, writer, researcher, fighter for the truth, a brilliant man, patriot. We're still on air, and I want to thank my listeners today. And thank you, Eric, for doing your part in getting this broadcast up. And I want to thank David Pidcock and all of you. Until the next installment of The French Connection, be well and bring more people to the fight.